Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. And if you have something to say and would like to be featured on the network, please visit speakuptalkradio.com for all of the details, or contact us at PR@speakuptalkradio.com. Well, as usual, I have another fine author with me today. She is Pamela Jean Horder Moore. Pam was born and raised in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, and graduated from Slippery Rock University with a degree in English and Fine Arts. Her childhood passion for writing led her to pursue a career in communications. During her work life, she wrote advertising copy and feature stories, served as media, public relations, and employee communications coordinator, and produced documentation for the IT industry. There was little time to write creatively, but she authored a historical novel, Brief Candles, in 1983, published a short story, Lamont, in 1988, and managed a historical online discussion group. When she retired, she returned to the drafts she had written throughout the years. The book Love Quest was the most complete of all her drafts. Written in the late 1980s, it was a summation of all of her most romantic notions. Pam does not consider herself a romance or fantasy author. She feels that the term generalist is more fitting description of her writing. She plans to devote the rest of her life to writing and to her passion for history and genealogy. And she's ready to fill in the blanks today, so welcome to the network, Pam.
Thank you very much, Pat. I appreciate that welcome very much.
Oh, I appreciate having you here. I loved your website. It states, Pamela Horder Moore, author, compelled to write. I write because I have to. And you say, ever since the age of six, I have been driven to write. So that is a long-term passion. Tell us a little about that and why you decided to put that on your website to greet your visitors.
Well, I think I've, of course, networked with a lot of other authors, and all of us have a different story as to how we began. And some people have come to this late in life, but I think it's important for people to know that this has been part of my life since I first learned to read letters together in first grade when I was 6 years old. And I had teachers along the way who were willing to help me and coach me and were very positive and very supportive of my writing. I didn't have quite so much support, perhaps, from the counselors. And when I was around 14 years old, the counselor called me down to talk about the schedule for the next year. And he said, "What do you want to be?" "Well, I want to be a writer." And he said to me, "Well, I don't know, maybe in the future you really won't want to do that." And I wrote in my diary that night, "Not be a writer? Never." And so it was just obvious to me that when I pursued a career after college, that it would involve writing of some sort or another. And one good thing about being, I guess, a liberal arts English major is that when you go out in the world, you can almost do anything that involves writing. You're not going to make much money, but in my case, I did the obvious thing that one would do back in 73. I started working for weekly and daily newspapers. Then I started working as a public relations coordinator for a nonprofit. Then I went to a consulting firm, flew around the country, trying to develop communications programs between management and employees. Then finally worked at Westinghouse, and then went on from there to be a consultant in the IT industry. And that's when I began to make some decent money as a technical writer by the time I had all this experience under my belt. But I knew while I was doing this that this wasn't going to satisfy me. So along the way, I was writing. And one of the things I was writing was Love Quest. I was always attracted to mythology. Bullfinch's mythology was such a joy for me to read when I was in high school and college, and I returned to it again and again. And the love story of Eros and Psyche, Eros being the god of love and Psyche, a mortal woman who's very beautiful but very flawed. And this story always appealed to me because, especially as I grew a little older, when I was in my 30s, perhaps, I began to feel that the romance and marriage was getting beyond me at that age. So I started to write Love Quest based on Eros and Psyche and the myth, and the idea of Eros being the god of love, the ideal epitome of a mate, and Psyche, all too human, lets other people define her. She doesn't appreciate who she is. She's vulnerable to the interests of people who don't have her best interest in mind. So she's invulnerable to their influence. And she hates the things about her that make her different from others. And I enlarge, this is something that Bullfinch doesn't talk much about, but I enlarge it in my book because I think that describes a lot of us. We listen to people who really don't have our best interests at heart. We let other people define us, and that sometimes makes us feel bad about ourselves and negative about ourselves. And that's how Psyche offends the goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of beauty, who has gifted her with her great beauty. And, of course, then Eros, her son, is called upon to punish Psyche. But while punishing her, he stabs himself with his own arrow and falls in love with Psyche. Well, Aphrodite is a mother, and she can see no good coming out of a romance between her son Eros and this mortal woman Psyche, who doesn't even appreciate who she is, and certainly has insulted her because she denigrates her gift. So she tries to keep them apart, but Cupid has to make a decision. Does he continue child, or does he pursue his own destiny? Well, he decides to pursue his own destiny and connives to get Psyche in the palace that he has built for her. But he dares not reveal himself to her because his mother will know. He's pretending to his mother that he's wounded with this terrible wound, and he's in his sickbed. Well, in the meantime, his spiritual self has created this delusion to draw Psyche in. So he has to appear invisible to her. Otherwise, his mother will know what he's doing. She will know who he is, and the whole facade will come crashing down upon him. Well, this goes on for a while. Psyche loves Cupid, even though he just loves Eros, even though she can't see Eros. She loves him because he's the perfect lover. He's so gentle. He's so kind. He's so sweet. He tries to win her love. But she gets home sick, so she goes back home. And while she's home, she's under the influence of those people who don't have her best interest in mind and who convince her that Eros, being invisible, is really a monster in disguise, and convince her that she should kill him. But when she returns to the palace and attempts to kill Eros as he's asleep in a different wing of the palace, she sees him for what he is. But he wakes up upon seeing and sees her with a knife in her hand, and he understands her motives, so then he tells her, you know, you've betrayed me. The whole facade vanishes, and he flies away. So Psyche must spend the rest of her life trying to win his love again. And Aphrodite would just assume that Psyche was out of the picture altogether. And when Psyche makes an attempt to pursue her son, Aphrodite gives her a choice. Either you can return to your village and nothing will happen to you and you'll just live a loveless, gray, mediocre, boring life, and you'll still be free. You can keep your life, but it's going to be dull and mediocre. If you pursue this path, I'm going to try my best to see that you fail, because I don't want you to gain your heart's desire. I don't want you to regain my son's affection. I don't want him to love you, and I don't want you to love him. So Psyche has to make a choice. And for both of them, they, Eros and Psyche, they have a lot of growing up to do, and a trial and a journey and a path to follow. It's a difficult path. Either of them, Eros can just give in to his mother and just do what she tells him to do and forget about his romance with Psyche. Psyche can return to her village and have a lackluster life. That's the safe path. But then there's the difficult path that allows both of them to grow and as individuals and become better than what they might have been. And I think this is a story for a lot of us. The message is, I think we can take the easy path. And it's very easy to do that, just to sit around and let your life go by. But it takes a lot of work to pursue your heart's desire and work towards that and never stop. And that's a difficult path.
Right.
And that's one of the messages I want to instill, is it's the difficult path that makes us better than what we would ordinarily be. This is what makes us great achievers and allows us to make great things and be great people in this world.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, so many of these myths from the past are extremely relevant today, as you mentioned earlier. And so this story is much more than just a romance or a fantasy. There's a lot going on. There's forbidden love and betrayal and loyalty and fidelity. And as you say, to urge the reader to understand that we do have opportunities to grow. So tell us about the cover art. I love the cover of it.
Yes, I have to give credit to Dreams Time and Mike Haywood for that cover. And when I found it on Dreams Time, I was just overwhelmed, and I said, this is it. This is what I want to put on my cover. It's a great cover, and I'm very thankful that I discovered it.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful cover. Job well done. So you have your hardback historical novel, Brief Candles, that you first published in 1983, and that's set in England during the Wars of the Roses, a period of history that obviously has fascinated you as well. So you like to look back a little in your writings.
Yes, and that's why I guess that's appropriate, because another one of my passions is genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
So I do have a good tie and a feeling for history and a passion for history, not only my own, but of course, the Wars of the Roses and American history as well. And so that's why initially when I went to college, I was a history major, but I took what I thought was a better decision for me and changed majors to English. But I've always loved history. That being said, I've been attracted to dystopias and science fiction all my life as well. And a couple of the books that I've started, but it's like all writers, it's easy for writers to start a book. The hard part is finishing it. And I have two dystopias that I have in draft, and they're pretty well along, but since I can't seem to find, one just meanders on and on and on. I love the characters, I love the premise, but it's like, I really need a plot for this. So that is one of the problems that writers face. All of us are real good starters.
I love that. The plotless book, right?
yes. And I love some of the things I'm doing with it and some of the scenarios. And it's like, okay, fine. We have this dystopia where you have one class of Americans really divided against the other class, and there's interesting things happening. And one of the things that you can probably note in my writing is that I have a great appeal. You know, I'm very connected or feel very connected with young people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that in this dystopia I discovered as I was going on and on and on and on, was that I was beginning to develop another theme about how young people can bring about change. And we see how young people do bring about change. And so this was one of the things that I saw as I was writing this dystopia, and I thought to myself, that pretty much falls in with themes that have attracted me since I myself was a child. Mm-hmm. The statement I would make is young people inherit a world that they didn't make, and they only have as much power as adults give them. Mm. But yet, we see how young people can be agents for change. We see that all the time. And I grew up, of course, in a period where young people were very much agents for change, because I grew up, of course, during the anti-war movement and civil rights movement and women's rights movement. So I understand how idealistic young people can influence the world to the good, but I also understand how much they can be victimized by the world because of their lack of power in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you really are a generalist. You have fantasy and fiction and history and dystopian, and you're currently working on a novella based on your 1965 diary. And Pam, when I read that about you, it actually made me smile because I had a laugh. I still have my diary from 1965. You and I are not too far in age. And I, maybe every other week there was an entry, and it went like, went to the mall with mom for ice cream. The next week, guinea pig died. The next week, tooth fairy. And the next, no school today. And I thought, I can't imagine what my novella would read based on that. So I'm sure you had fleshed yours out much greater than that one. So maybe give us a peek into the new one you're writing.
Oh, sure. I have all my diaries except the first four, which I was stupid about and threw them away. But I started my diary in 61 and 63, and I had one from 66 and 68 that are no longer existent, but I kept the 65 one. And I read through it and transcribed it just a few years ago, and there were passages in it that made me laugh. I was obsessed with my hair. I don't remember ever being so obsessed with my hair. Every day I was talking about my hair and how it looked and the new hairstyles I was going to try. And it was amusing, really, for me to read this after all these years. And there were some passages that struck me as funny. You know, I'd say something like, and then I cried, all because of pride, all because of my pride. And, you know, a lot of purple passages. I hardly remember that girl, but I do understand. I was an introvert. I was bullied. I was isolated. I was 14 years old. I was unpopular. It was a struggle for me, and I think 14 is a struggle for a lot of young people. Mm-hmm. And it was a hard year, but there was some inner strength that kept me going. And as I reflect on that year and read my diary entries and remember those times, I'm really impressed with really the inner strength that I had then, because I was quite, you know, I was bullied. I did struggle in school. I was introverted. I used to dive into my books, and instead of communicating with the other kids, and that was a choice I made. But it's the kind of thing that kind of isolated me from the others and made me unpopular, and then made me a target for bullies. But by and large, everyone was nice. People were nice to me there. And I had the popular girls. Some of them I had known since I was in first grade, and they were very sweet to me. They were always kind. And then there were the girls who were like me, you know, not extremely popular, but nice girls, and I got along with them. And then, of course, the boys. The boys were a lot of fun. I'm the oldest child. I have four kid brothers, I have dozens of male cousins. I'm well accustomed to interacting with boys and interacting with males. And so all the teasing that went on with them, that was fun. And of course, music was very important to me back then. It was one of my refuges. That and just diving into my room, shutting the door, turning on my radio, and then writing. I didn't write very good stuff. I wrote mysteries back then. I was attracted to Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and the Happy Hollisters and some of the other children that for some reason their parents were liberal enough that they didn't mind them engaging in all these mysteries and risking their lives hunting down nefarious criminals. And I was like, oh, these parents are real liberal, because I know my mother wouldn't let me do that when I was that age. But I would write these mysteries, and they were pretty bad. But at least it was something that obsessed me and something that drove me. And when I write this novella, I want to point out how music really grounded me and how, in a way, I felt more connected with those people, the artists who sang that music, than I did with the people around me. So it was for me a very strange year, but I don't think I'm unique.
No. As you're speaking, I can relate to some of the things you're saying, and especially music. That was extremely important. At this point in time, I could remember every lyric to every song because that was just so immersed and embedded. It's interesting how that can become a part of your life and really kind of help you get through things.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I get what you're saying. So we can look forward to that coming out one of these days. And your website also features some of your short writings. I want to talk about one in particular. I really enjoyed reading it, and it was Lamont that you published in 1988. As I was reading it, I wished it was longer, just started to feel for the character there. So tell us, where did that come from? Was that someone you knew?
It was inspired by a true event. About 40 years ago, I was working as public relations coordinator for AAA in Pittsburgh, and I presented a Heroes Award to two young boys who had stopped a school bus full of children that was out of control. And as I was watching them being honored on the stage of the auditorium, I could sense their embarrassment over the publicity. And it impressed me, and for a few years I kind of like kept it under my hat. But then, 10 years after it, I was inspired to write about it. And it was a moment in my life when I was able to write about someone completely different from myself. I think most writers, and I think they have to agree this is true, most writers, even when they're writing fiction, or no matter what they're writing, they're in it. They're writing about themselves in a way, and their own experiences. I had a chance. I felt I had a chance and was inspired to have a chance to walk in Lamont's shoes and live vicariously for just a brief moment of time as a 12-year-old African-American boy living in Pittsburgh in the 1970s. And it was a metamorphosis that I treasure. And when I presented the story to the writers group, because it's interesting that you say you wished it was longer, they just urged me to write more about Lamont. But, of course, you know, I don't have Lamont's experience
right.
enough to carry that metamorphosis on for any great length.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a moment in time when I could see into these young people's lives and see what they were feeling. And I sent the story out and got rejections on it in 1988, but authors know there's rejections, and then there's rejections. And I sent it to Red Book, and they loved the story, and they told me so, but it just wasn't a good fit for them. And finally, I found a Christian young people's magazine called Alive in St. Louis, and they published it. And I've been in communication with them, of course, since, because naturally I would wonder if they owned the story, having published it in 88. But that magazine is no longer in publication, and then I was told, go ahead, it's yours. Mm-hmm. So then I had to put it on my website. And, yes, it, for me, I really love it because I think it's a rare event when a writer can step into the shoes of someone so completely different and actually live like them, think like them, feel like them. It's something that doesn't happen all the time.
Mm-hmm. And I get exactly what you're saying, and now I can correct myself for asking you to make it longer because you just had a glimpse of what it must be like. And for you then to have tried to make a whole story out of that, you would have been forcing it probably or trying to stretch it. It may not have worked. So it was just that glimmer that you got and you had to get it on paper.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I understand that. I do. And you know what, Pam, I also appreciated the piece you did on your father. That was very personal and poignant.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank
mm-hmm.
you. And I appreciate it because, as you'll see, when I do come out with my novella, and when I was 14, my father and I did not get along. He fought from the minute I was 9 until the minute I left home permanently when I was 23. As a matter of fact, he asked me to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Because, but I understand now, because I was the oldest, I had 4 kid brothers. He was I think he was in his 60s by that time, no doubt. I was a financial burden, or getting to be a financial burden on him. I didn't contribute anything to my life and my livelihood in that house. I didn't give them rent. I didn't pay for my food. So when he asked me to leave, it was a reasonable request, and I thought, woo. Yeah, I had a feeling of freedom when he asked me to leave. Because I said, now I fly on my own wings or I go black. Mm-hmm. My mother was appalled. You're throwing one of my kids out. But I was happy in the long run. I found out that I could actually get myself in a little apartment and live on my own, for at that time, $125 a month. I'm sorry, $125 a week was what I was making. $125 a week working at the daily newspaper. And I managed to find a place that was about $125 a month.
Mm-hmm.
The little attic, if you were over 5'2", you would hit yourself on the head.
Oh, my.
The ceiling. That's how tiny it was. But it gave me a chance to be an adult, and I thank him for it. But of course, he's gone now,
yeah.
So I can't. A lot of the things that he was right about, I can't thank him for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shame that he and I were so much alike that we fought so often all through my childhood. He wanted me to grow up faster than I was ready to grow up,
mm-hmm.
and. Both of us really made a mistake in our relationship, but I'm glad that towards the end, once I began to be on my own and made a success of myself and became more like the woman that he wanted me to be, then we got along famously. But that was just a few years before he passed away. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful for those last 2 years.
Yeah, at least you had that opportunity. And I think your telling of all of these stories that you write about are very relatable. There's so many people out there that have the same feelings and circumstances as you. And I just think it's a gift for you to be vulnerable enough and open enough to put it out there so that others could say, oh, wow, I'm not alone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's one important thing that writers can do, and one of the services that they provide, and it's one of the obligations if you must know that that a writer faces. And I'm going to say something right now that's crude, but it's kind of like what I tell people. A writer who writes for himself is like masturbation. You are supposed to share your gift. This is your gift. It's just like Psyche and her beauty. If your gift is writing, you are supposed to share that with the world. You must do service to the world. You must do service to your gift. And that means sharing it. And if I make someone say to themselves, you know, I really enjoyed that, I felt something when I read that, then I've accomplished that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a quote we don't hear every day, right? You've heard it here first, folks. you're amazing. I really love your honesty. I think that's a beautiful way to live a life and to share. So, Pam, we've danced around a lot of different topics. I think we've really covered quite a bit. I'm sure there's more, but is there anything specifically that you wanted to bring up that we should talk about before we head out?
I just wanted another comment that I like to make is that many people can write well. This is what I've discovered. There are a lot of people who write well. However, there's more to creative writing than just being able to write well. You have to be a good storyteller as well. And there's only a subset of good writers who are also good storytellers. The other good writers find that there's more satisfaction perhaps in book reviews or journalism or public relations or something like that. There's only a few writers, good writers, who are good enough storytellers to keep readers engaged for the long term. And that's why I think some of my favorite writer is Mark Twain, because he's just a natural born storyteller. I enjoyed the last book series that I really enjoyed was The Hunger Games trilogy. And I think there was a good story there, and not only a good story there, but a believable, admirable heroine for young women to respect and look up to, but also a message about post-traumatic stress and the horrors of politics upon decent people. And so there's a lot there that I've really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to write a history of the Wars of the Roses. I've been studying it since I was 12 years old. And I was going to write another novel. My feeling, even though I'm very much interested in young Edward V, who I first was attracted to and who I first read about when I was 12 years old myself. But I think with my next effort, I've been urged to write a history, a nonfiction history, and I think at this point I can do it. I think I have accumulated enough knowledge. It's just the idea that this is going to be an effort for many, many years to draw all this information together from a period in Britain's history from around 1450 to 1500, that's a broad scope. Mm-hmm. And that's going to take me a long time.
Absolutely.
Anyway, and I hope I live long enough. This is another thing I wanted to say. I hope I live long enough to put all these projects of mine on paper and get them out to people.
Right.
But I don't know. I just, you know, I spent a lot of years working, but that's what life is, and we all understand that you spend a lot of years of your life spending time doing something that other people want you to do, and they're paying you to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you do that, you thank God that you have a job that you can do that with, and a lot of your creative pursuits kind of get put on the back burner, but it doesn't have to be forever.
Right, right. And at least you're taking advantage of that now. And that's another important message for folks. You reach that point where you finally have some time. Well, get out there and do what it is that your passion and your heart tells you to do. And obviously, this is your passion. And so you've got a lot of work to do, my friend. We've got a lot more reading to do from you. So where can folks go then to learn more about you and to purchase your book?
Well, my website is PamelaHorder-Moore, MOORE.com. Okay. So that's Pamela Horder. I better spell Horder. PamelaHorder-Moore.com. That's my author's website. I'm also on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, and they can buy my books from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Smashwords. Hopefully, the libraries are beginning to get the newsletters as well containing information about my book. My book was published originally last year, but the process of distribution, marketing, and everything else takes a longer time than I would have ever imagined.
Right, it sure does. There's a lot involved in that. So we'll send folks to PamelaHorder-Moore.com. The book is Love Quest, your short stories. There's just so much on your website for folks to take a look at. Pam, what a pleasure to have you today. Thank you for your honesty and just sharing, just raw you, and sharing your books and your passions with us today. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Pat. It's been a pleasure.